Coming at you like a Nolan Ryan fastball from the Hoban Law Group office here in beautiful downtown Denver, Colorado. This is the Hoban Minute, and I'm your host, Eric Singular. I'm here with the one, the only, president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Mr. Bob Hoban. And Bob, it's been a long day for us. We were up very early this morning on an educational forum for the country of Ecuador and the opportunities presented by the industrial hemp crop as a new emerging agricultural commodity. So let's reflect for a moment on the day that we've had and getting to speak with the folks in Ecuador. And I know, you know, you have a lot of experience going down to Latin America and speaking about how hemp, industrial hemp, is the backbone of the global cannabis industry, this wonderful Bob Hobanism, if you will. And so before we jump into a conversation about some other topics, let's just reflect a little bit on that.
Yeah, so our great partners, Javier and Jose, out of Guayaquil, Ecuador, with our law firm, moved forward with legislation a few years ago. And that actually came into fruition in 2019. And when it did, it was a milestone for that country. And they have asked for assistance and they have asked for support. And we've brought different people to the table. And as that legislation was enacted, today what we talked about was, how do you put it in place? How do you begin to act on it? How do you use this legislation that's out there that is, you know, earth-shattering to a certain respect, 1% THC, industrial hemp, but also what I'm very proud of is through those gentlemen in Ecuador and the Ecuadorian government and its Ministry of Agriculture, they're looking at this thing very, very carefully. What did other countries do that succeeded or did not succeed? What are some of the lessons we could learn from this experiment, if you will, across Latin America? And it really has been a fascinating experiment. But at the end of the day, that is what today was all about. Now that we've got legislation, what happens? Do we go all in on cannabinoids? Do we focus on food or grain, related distribution channels? Do we look at fiber? And that was what it was about today. Just like you talked about. You talked about the grain uses and looking at hemp from a commodity-based perspective versus just a profitable single-purpose crop, which is not so profitable these days, given the sort of contraction of the industry and the lack of, you know, easy to manipulate and operate within regulations. So anyway, that's what today was all about, and it was extremely exciting. And the feedback we got after the fact was, thank you for that presentation. Thank you for that well-rounded discussion, because it presented all different aspects of how farmers and how you look at this plant from an agricultural perspective. It's not a plant based on a single purpose that's going to come in and save the day economically. It can in certain places. In the United States, we talk about Pennsylvania and some other states have looked at legalizing marijuana in New York for adult use to sort of salvage the budget for economic gain. And the Latin American governments have come out that way, but they're learning and they're trying to learn from their neighbors, which is really, really encouraging because it's a tremendous opportunity.
Well, and there's something special about South America. And I say that as someone who's never traveled there. I can only imagine the kind of feelings that you have about South America, getting to spend some time down there in Colombia, Brazil, Uruguay, all the places that you've been around. And maybe some of that kind of special element comes from the fact that these places have a rich history of cannabis cultivation, which is very, very interesting to me, especially nowadays. When you look at hemp, and one of the things we talked about, a big component of this was genetics, because it does, establishing an industry, as we saw here in the United States, it really starts with, what the heck are you going to put in the ground? You have your regulations, you have your policy, but when it really comes time to begin the process, the sourcing of genetics becomes a big issue. And so you look at Ecuador, you look at a country that's sitting right there on the equator that does have, you look at its neighbor Colombia, this rich history of marijuana cultivation, And it was interesting to hear Ryan Douglas, who has a lot of experience. He's come onto this podcast. He's worked in Canada as a master grower for Canopy Growth, one of the biggest cannabis companies in the world. And he spent time in Colombia. And to hear him talk about these are the challenges you're going to face, just like you're saying, that people have done this. Countries have done this around the world, and you have to learn from the mistakes that they made. You have to learn from the obstacles that they've faced so that as you implement your program and as you really begin to foster industrial hemp as an agricultural commodity, you're not just spinning your wheels, but you really are optimizing it for the existing core competencies and infrastructure that exists in your country. And that was what was fun about Ecuador, was getting to do this research, getting to look at what are the latest reports from USDA, where's their consumption, their annual grain consumption, their fiber market. They have an interesting relationship with OPEC and a long history of oil, petroleum production and extraction, and as well as floriculture. And so it's really interesting to get this opportunity to look at these countries, to do this kind of case study analysis, and get to talk to these people.
But also, Eric, doing it at not as an observer, as a participant, as someone right. that's actually involved in the crafting of where this country's brand new cannabis, Canyamo, industrial hemp, or sometimes medicinal cannabis programs, putting them into motion. And, you know, what you said a moment ago about sort of learning, you ain't going to learn what you don't want to know. And these companies have begun to understand, the countries have begun to understand, and the companies that operate within these countries have begun to understand that you do have to learn from what's going on around. None of us have all the answers, particularly in a brand new emerging industry that has such a global impact. And the Latin American region is fascinating for that, for the reasons you described, coupled with what we've talked about, against the backdrop of this narco trade and, American drug policy beginning in the 60s and 70s that was really just changed the landscape of Latin America as a whole. So against that whole backdrop, you've got commercial regulated cannabis. And it's interesting because many of the countries and their programs allow for genetic registration as the very first thing you can do. Working in Southeast Asia right now, working in some Southern African countries, they all start with regulation in its simplest form. Register the genetics so that we understand what works, what doesn't, what's stable, what's not, particularly if it's a hemp program to get you within that 0.3 or 1%, like Ecuador, the 1% program. So genetics really matter. Now, as we talked about this in the context of South America with genetics, we came to the table into a country that enacted a 1% THC standard. So 1% THC is interesting because there are limit-pushing cannabinoid-yielding varieties in the United States that sit at 0.3 delta-9 THC, one way or the other, however you measure it. But 1% gives you great latitude. We haven't seen that kind of latitude anywhere else in the world in a commercial program because it's 0.2 in Europe, certified OECD, strictly enforced. United States, a hodgepodge of the new 0.3 high CBD, high cannabinoid genetics, and beginning now to look at more diversified crops for grain production, for fiber production, certified genetics. And then in the Latin American market, that's not an obvious thing, nor are there answers to the question that they are asking is, how do we get the most beneficial, optimized genetics to go 1% THC and still produce a broad range of cannabinoids that'll be useful in wellness and food products? That's an answer that many people have, a question that many people have answers to, but there's not a lot of answers right now. And that's what's exciting about this.
So in the spirit of intellectual property, which of course is the focus this week for the Hoban Law Group and highlighting all of the great work that the intellectual property practice group does, this is the issue that kind of comes to my mind, which is every country has different laws as it relates to plant variety protection and the protecting of IP as it relates to genetics. And so you look at Ecuador, you look at these South American countries that are so excited about getting their program set up, and you have all of these agronomic issues. How is a variety going to perform in a place where you have about 12 hours of daylight consistently? But there's this other component, and it's something that I've run into a little bit, which is, are companies who take a lot of pride in the IP of their genetics, in the breeding of their varieties of hemp, are they going to be hot to trot to get their varieties into these South American countries because they want to be a first mover down there? Or are there going to be some concerns about putting your variety in a place where it might not be protected from an IP perspective the same way it is, say, here in the United States?
Great, great question. It's come up time and time again. Colombia, for the last 3+ years, has, there were some limits to that in terms of deadlines, but for the better part of the last 4 years, I've been talking with clients about registering genetics in Colombia. And to plant commercial agriculture in Colombia, no matter what the plant material is, you have to register genetics in a Colombian-specific way, all right? So it's registered in Colombia. It becomes a recognized and lawfully permitted and regulated variety that can be grown in Colombian agriculture, which is important because it's a great agricultural producing country. Now, you bring that in and you register it. What's to stop anybody else from looking at that assay, that certificate of analysis, and saying I've got the same thing, or creating the same thing, or naming it something else? So there's several layers to this, and I don't purport to be an intellectual property attorney, although our IP department at Home and Law Group is really fantastic. You've got this notion of PBR, and not Pabst Blue Ribbon, but plant breeders' rights, okay? Plant breeders' rights are recognized as a protectable form of intellectual property, in a sense, in the European Union. There's PBR protection, YAP. One of our wonderful of counsel attorneys here from the Netherlands has spent an entire career looking at how to protect plant varieties, both outside of cannabis primarily and within cannabis. So you can have that PBR protection. In the United States, that's enacted by FDA patentability, in effect. So patenting a plant material composition. All right. Now, another way to do it is to register it with a government and ensure that registration, and the governments have generally been good about this. And when I mean the governments, I mean working with Colombian government, working with the Peruvian government, working with Uruguay, working in Costa Rica and Panama, looking at how to bring genetics in. And they want to ensure that the genetics you're trying to register, because it's not really a seed, it's a certificate of analysis. They want to see that registered, and they want to see that you have the rights from the breeder of that variety who can demonstrate that it's been stabilized, that they've given you permission. So that's another way to sort of protect your IP without being technical intellectual property protection. And these things are critical. In doing business over the years with the Polish Institute of Natural Fibers and Medicinal Plants and their plant varieties, they had described a desire to make sure that if there were varieties from the Polish Institute licensed out, being brought into new jurisdictions, Latin America in particular, that we ensured that the IP was in fact protected. And so there are a number of ways to do it, but it becomes critically important in this day and age. And think about the Ecuador example to round this all up. Going back to Ecuador, you got 1% THC. Tell me how many varieties you can think of that are commercially viable that would be up to 1% THC to produce high-yielding industrial hemp crops. Not really asking you that question, but at the end of the day, those varieties do exist. And there's people listening to this, and then there's guys that have been breeders and that like to crossbreed that are getting excited about even the thought of this. But at the end of the day, stabilized, repeatable genetics, that is the name of the game, and that allows you to register, which in turn allows you to protect that intellectual property as something novel. And that's what we're seeing happen in real time in Ecuador, which is pretty darn interesting, pretty cool.
Well, and there's something particularly interesting about cannabis breeding, because so much of it we know happened underground. It was something that people were doing, particularly in the black market marijuana space, where people were having so much fun and freedom to mess around with the genetics. And it's interesting to see an industry that is, to use your words, Bob, sprung from night into the sun, where you have these guys who were operating illegally, but they're plant experts. They're botanists when it comes to cannabis. And, you know, what I see, particularly in a conversation around grain and fiber in Ecuador, is you have the majority of these varieties that were bred and originated at high northern latitudes. And more than likely, the thing that it's going to take to get these varieties acclimated to that very unique climate that's at the equator is probably a little bit of breeding, maybe a little bit of genetic editing. And we've already seen this in the United States with folks in Texas who are looking at these Polish varieties or other European varieties, and they're like, hey, we are really excited to start playing around here a little bit, because we put this in the ground and it only got a couple feet tall and started flowering. It's not really performing the way it did in the north.
You know, 1,700 miles to the north, it would perform in a much greater way. And not to interrupt so much as just to highlight. And what about ditchweed? And we're talking about road trips where you're looking at industrial hemp varieties grown in the wild, grown in ditches, ditchweed, literally in Nebraska, and looking at taking the breeder that's excited. And you said they had fun, fun, right? This is the prime point, because this has become commercialized. There, if you can do something successful and protect its IP and register it, then the world is your oyster in terms of being a plant breeder in this day and age in this industry. So it's terribly exciting. But what if you took a stable variety and you crossbred it with, for example, Iowa, Nebraska ditchweed that has grown. Nobody plants it. It just grows year after year after year, and it thrives in that environment. But it goes to your point. You got to have varieties that are tested and acclimated, because if they don't grow in a particular region, then what's the point? And you don't know unless you try. And it takes the better part of a growing season to gather that data and understand that. And that's unfortunately when people think about great varieties of cannabis or marijuana or the strains that they like. The same thing with industrial hemp. If it performs here and it's great, that might not mean anything else 3,700 miles away in the Southern Hemisphere. And those are the things that are really interesting. And you're right to think of that stuff too.
Well, and you know, what we've always talked about and always tried to highlight and hammer home is that just look at other agricultural commodities. Just look at other crops. Look at the amount of plant breeding that's done in corn and the amount of intellectual property that surrounds the breeding of different corn genetics, and the fact that genetics don't last very long in other industries, meaning that corn varieties come and go pretty quickly. And some of the hemp varieties that we're working with, they've been around for a long time. So we're just sitting at the precipice, I guess, of really opening up some new breeding in cannabis. But let's shift a little bit. And I don't, not even sure if this qualifies as IP, but I'll throw it out there just because it comes to mind. when the Colombian market opened, we know that a lot of the big Canadian LPs took a lot of interest, and they put a stake in the ground down in Colombia. And maybe it was to capture some potential market share, but where does trademarking or IP or just the idea of a new market opens? Maybe it's in South America, maybe it's somewhere else in the world, but these large companies that at the time had a lot of capital, they see an opportunity and they go in there and they try to capitalize in Colombia, as we've talked about here on the Hoban Minute. That opportunity seemed to have kind of come and gone, or maybe even these companies dumped some money into like shell companies down in Colombia that never went anywhere simply because there were obstacles, there were issues. But give us a little sense of why is it so important for companies when a new jurisdiction opens in a new part of the world to try to get in there and stake some claim?
It's not just staking a claim, too. Think about it this way. There's some context that you lose when you don't know a lot of facts about a particular region. And I didn't know some of these data points when you think about Latin America. How many people does Colombia have, population-wise? Take a wild guess. I was wrong. You'll be wrong. But what do you think?
400,000.
Colombia has 53 million people.
Wow.
That's more than Canada. That's more than California. This is a burgeoning region. This is a region with huge populations. And increasingly, because of, frankly, the evolution of public policy as it relates to narco trafficking and the U.S. drug war, people are becoming educated and be given a chance. And there's a burgeoning economy across that entire region.
It's not your grandfather's Colombia.
It's definitely not your grandfather's Colombia. But it's 50 million people. When a market with 50 million people opens up to anything, you have to pay attention to it, even if it has, you know, potentially political problems and history and so forth and so on. Every place does. So that was really how things began. 53 million people, a country opening it up with low-cost agricultural production, with a great history of ag production, trade relationships, an attachment to the Americas because of various trade agreements, particularly recently under the Clinton administration. And those things lent itself to a really, really good environment to do business from North American enterprise in Canada, the LPs, the publicly traded companies, and down and in Colombia, being one of the first to come out. And it was an opportunity to do some good for that altruistic purpose, because you're talking about bringing something commercial and regulated to a country that had been previously decimated by narco violence, drug trade, so forth and so on. So you take all those things and you turn it around. Licensees come into place. Well, the Canadians who just at this, remember the timing matters too, we're just at the beginning of the Canadian stock markets, the Toronto Exchange and the Canadian Exchange starting to amass millions, hundreds of millions, close to billions of dollars. So there's a lot of money going into those markets lawfully, publicly, into cannabis. And there's a place with 53 million people that I can go and put a foothold, put a stronghold in this particular region as if it's a game of Risk. Right? Let's move all those piles of things here. You go there. The companies came out. Talk about trademarking or sort of recognition of names. Their brands are names that stick in your head. There's Chiron or Kiron. There's La Santa. There's Blueberries. There's Clever Leaves. There's Farmacielo. These are companies that if you follow industry opportunities and industry companies, these are companies that have made some strong moves. Clever Leaves recently entered into an arrangement, and that was national news. And so things are happening, but it starts with recognizing the opportunity, recognizing the context. I keep going back to that. If I'm in Colombia and I can get a marijuana license or a hemp license, which one do I go for? I go for the marijuana license because marijuana sells for more per pound or per kilo. But it's not the right answer when you apply context, because context would dictate that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of distribution outlets for non-psychoactive cannabinoids from industrial hemp, whereas there's only three or four handfuls of outlets for THC-related products. And the Canadians have a two-year lead with their infrastructure, even though it's a regulation that makes things cost more. So bottom line is, looking for an outpost, looking for a progressive regime from a public policy standpoint, and looking for a serviceable population. And that's where we are today. Mexico, Brazil, Colombia. 400 plus million people in those three countries. Cannabis laws, nationalized healthcare system participation and sponsorship. And just a year and a half, 2 years ago, all we could think about was distributing these products into the European Union because they had 430 million people. Well, the tides have changed, and the leadership in those Latin American countries has recognized cannabis as an economic driver and a way out of the post-COVID economic doldrums, and that is where we are today. And that's something that not everybody's going to point out, even though it's a long story to get to the ultimate conclusion. This is the opportunity, this is the time, and this is the plan that's going to make it happen in those regions. Hopefully, depending on what happens to our country in November on this election, there is some progress, recognizing that this plant can be an economic driver, and that if this country recognizes that it has a prominent place in cannabis policy for a variety of reasons, and embrace that and create legislation and open up its markets to that, I know that that economic driver and that notion of plant-based economies, cannabis or otherwise, would really create a storm that would really awaken the global economic environment overall, not just to get us out of COVID, but going forward.
It's hard to even know what to pose to you after that, Bob, because that was such a wonderful cherry on top. But just to drive us home, talking about context and sitting here with you, somebody who spent a lot of time in the European Union and in these European countries and speaking to cannabis policy and cannabis industry leaders in those countries, my question to you, kind of looking at Latin America as the new opportunity, is just when you go down there and you're around these cultures that are so different than Europe and probably just so many innumerable ways, what is it to you about the Latin American culture that you think is just, it makes sense, and the iron is hot down in Latin America for cannabis, maybe as it relates to Europe, maybe as it relates to North America, but just this idea that there's something about the context and culture down south that is just well-suited to take advantage of this opportunity, whereas others, as you're stating, like here in our country, the opportunity is ripe, the opportunity is there, but it's just not quite being taken the way that it could be in these other countries.
To be brief, I think it's historical use, right? And I have numerous friends across that entire region, and what I've learned over the last 6 to 10 years is that Abuela would use cannabis to prepare something to help someone in her family with a condition, whether that's a bruised knee or a swollen joint or some sort of more serious genetic condition, that what we'd call homeopathic remedies are far more common. And interesting to me, the use of the cannabis plant is ingrained in that homeopathic remedy preparation sort of analysis. So folks have known this for a long, long time. They've used this plant, as we've always talked about, and we've known for a long, long time. So it's taking something that you would always get, grandma says take this, your aunt says take this, try this, that always worked, or at least had the effect of working, that sets the table for a commercialized environment. If you could look at, and then this is interesting because this is what came up in Uruguay. In Uruguay, when we kept asking people, we said, what do you think if they sell cannabis, they sell marijuana in pharmacies? Because that's the plan, $1.50 a gram. That was the plan at that point in time before it was implemented. I wouldn't go to the pharmacy. My mother might go to the pharmacy. My grandmother might go to the pharmacy because literally they were taking the flower and just crushing it up and saying, here, take this or take that. But they wouldn't use it themselves from a commercial environment. So that's really a generational thing that we just don't know how is going to play out in Latin America. It's cultural. It's generational. It'll be an interesting thing to study to see if medicinalized cannabis or institutionalized cannabis, where you take it and put it through a pharmaceutical ringer or implement it in a standardized fashion sold through commercial outlets, can compete with Abuela.
Absolutely. Well, it was a wonderful opportunity to, one, get to speak to the stakeholders in Ecuador and talk about some of the things that we've learned, and even more than that, just a wonderful opportunity to be alongside you, my friend, beyond the Hoban Minute, but actually, on a panel together. So
you were steadfast despite technical difficulties.
Yeah, it was a heck of a day, man. But for all of us here at the Hoban Minute, what can you say? It's been a great day. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.